funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Siege of Atlanta change the course of the United States Civil War? And how did the city's evolution before the war influence what it would ultimately become? Writer Mark Wortman's new book details Atlanta's remarkable history before and during the Civil War, when it went within a matter of decades from Native American territory to a railroad boomtown purged of its longtime inhabitants and remade by slave labor to a scorched ruin that by 1868 would rebound to a population of around 40,000 people. The new book is called The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta, and we are delighted to have Mark Wortman here to talk about it. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
Atlanta is really interesting in terms of the history of the U.S. in that it is still the only city to have been utterly destroyed by war, and there are still arguments taking place about the impact that that had and whether or not it was necessary.
Yeah. Well, I think that, in fact, we're coming up on the anniversary, the 145th anniversary, September 2nd, 1864, of the Confederate surrender of Atlanta. And I tend to think of that date as sort of an obscure date in history for most people. I think of it as perhaps the most significant event in American history, which you may wonder why. Well, it was really the moment in which it was clear that the Confederacy had no chance of winning the war. And up till that point, the possibility had remained. But with the fall of Atlanta, even though Northern forces were still stalemated outside of Richmond, with the fall of Atlanta, it was clear that the North would fight the war through to the end, and that the Confederates were going to be defeated.
And we should say that before that siege of Atlanta and the surrender of Atlanta by the Confederacy, there was also a very real possibility that Abraham Lincoln would not be reelected and would, in fact, be replaced by someone who wanted to simply stop the war.
Yeah. There's a question as to whether Lincoln would have lost his second run for the presidency. But what was quite clear was that the Northern Democrats, particularly a faction called the Peace Democrats, believed that they had a good chance, as long as General Sherman's forces remained stalemated besieging Atlanta, as long as General Grant's forces remained stalemated besieging Richmond, they had a good chance that the Northern voters would turn their backs on the war, which meant turning their backs on Lincoln, and go for their candidate. But with the fall of Atlanta, that possibility ended.
Let's jump back in time a little bit here to the days before the railroads came in. Native Americans had for decades been struggling to maintain their settlements there, only to be constantly undermined by the U.S. government.
Yeah. We tend to think of the Native Americans as being principally on the other side of the Mississippi from the east, in what we wrongly label the Old West. In fact, the Old West was North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama. And as the European Americans moved outwards, they continuously pushed back against the Native American frontier. Even as late as the late 1830s, a large section of northwest Georgia, nearly to the to where Atlanta was finally established, was Cherokee tribal land. It was a Cherokee, independent Cherokee nation. When the U.S. was established in 1776, was still Native American territory, and this was by treaty, and there was just no stopping this push by the European Americans to move into that territory. And it created, to my mind, a sentiment that said that land was to be taken, that populations could be displaced. This was in what today we would call ethnic cleansing, in which a large section of or a large population of indigenous inhabitants were simply packed up and at gunpoint forced to move out to the West.
Mark, what made Atlanta such an attractive location? It wasn't called Atlanta when Native Americans were first being moved out, but what made it such a particularly attractive location for European American conquest?
Okay. Well, Atlanta was one of the earliest, the results of one of the earliest government stimulus projects, you could say. A government-owned and surveyed railroad was built to run from the Tennessee River near today's Chattanooga and to run down to where we now know Atlanta to be. The idea being, let's get the Mississippi Valley farm produce to the coastal regions, and Atlanta was ideally situated at the cross point, a natural crossing point, geographic crossing point for going to the coasts, as well as going up to Tennessee and over into the Mississippi Valley region. Today we think of Atlanta as one of the world's great transit hubs. It started as a transit hub. It started as a crossing place for railroads, and still in the center of town, you can see the trains moving through Atlanta at all hours of the day and night on those same tracks. There were originally four railroads that crossed at Atlanta and that really built the city and made it so important in the lower South.
And I guess one of the original reasons that Sherman looked at Atlanta as a good target, besides the fact that it was well-connected, was that it was a good place from which to try and overtake the Army of Tennessee.
Yeah. Well, Atlanta was the heart of the Confederacy to its brains in Richmond. Atlanta sat as deep within the deepest part of the lower South, far removed, or so the people of Atlanta thought, far removed from any threat from the Union Army. Through much of the war, the coastal areas were threatened. Tennessee was gradually being overrun, Mississippi. But Atlanta was so far from the front that it filled up with refugees, and it also became the place to which the Confederacy moved many of its munitions manufacturing operations.
And
well,
continue, go ahead.
Yeah, but eventually, Sherman, who all the while during his fighting was seeing these cannons marked "Made in Atlanta," decided that he needed to take Atlanta. And the idea was finally by January 1864 that the Union Army, which had been so badly coordinated and generaled before this, under the chief command of Ulysses S. Grant, would now have a coordinated strategy. The army in Virginia, the Union Army in Virginia, would attack simultaneously with Sherman's advance, starting out from Tennessee and northwestern Georgia down towards Atlanta, moving down one of the important rail lines feeding into Atlanta.
It's interesting that you mentioned that the city was sort of off the beaten path in many ways and away from the front, because efforts to fortify it got underway relatively late in the game in terms of when the threat started to arise. At what point did the the leadership of the Confederacy realize that Atlanta was a very likely target?
Yeah. During 1861, 1862, Atlanta felt basically that the war was not something that needed to be worried about. In fact, the war was something that needed to be profited from. Atlanta was a boom town for the first 3 years of the war because of that removal from the front. But by 1863, or into 1863, July 1863, Vicksburg fell in Mississippi. Western parts of Tennessee had fallen as well, so the Mississippi River was a corridor open to Union forces. And so in early 1863, the Confederacy Confederate forces in Atlanta and asked a railroad engineer to lay out fortifications for the city. They brought in thousands of slave laborers from the countryside, and they began to create what I think may have been the one of the largest public works projects ever undertaken in early Southern history. And they built 10 miles of fortifications around the city of Atlanta. And these were almost medieval-style ramparts with huge earthworks connecting forts. And then in front of the earthworks, they cut down all the trees and sharpened them and laid them out in the direction that an attacking force might advance on them. They created barriers that were almost the equivalent of barbed wire. They also built fortifications along the Chattahoochee River, which served as a kind of natural moat between Atlanta and any force that might advance down from Tennessee. So by early 1864, Atlanta was ready for the possibility of attack. But again, nobody in Atlanta really believed that that would ever happen. They just thought, you know, the Confederate forces are going to hold them off. It's not going to be possible for them to get into the heart of Georgia.
Author Mark Wortman is my guest. We're talking about his new book, The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta. It's worth pausing here to note that although the boom town that was Atlanta was built largely on the backs of slave labor, there were residents within the city whose leanings were not strictly Confederate. There were people there who supported the cause of the Union.
The Atlanta is a curious place or a paradoxical place to think of as the heart of the Confederacy. Atlanta was a place unlike the lower South's more traditional cities in Charleston, Savannah, New Orleans, and the plantation areas of Georgia. It was a place where a man came to make his fortune, and it was a place that was considered an upstart city by many people in other people in the South. Many people in the South hated Atlanta. It was a place where the old hierarchies really didn't matter, and it was also an industrial center. Again, something very much out of keeping with the agrarian traditions of the South. But we need to keep in mind that Atlanta was, especially at the start of the war, was a very small place. There were probably only 11,000 residents of Atlanta at that time. But it was a dynamic place, and it was a place that had people who came from all over, because they knew there was the possibility in that fast-growth city to become rich. And so it attracted people who were, in many cases, from the north. It had a relatively large foreign population as well. It was also a place where there wasn't really the presence of slavery to the degree that there was in the more agrarian areas and in the port cities. There were of course slaves in Atlanta, and when a man got rich, as in the rest of the South, first thing he did was to buy land and to buy slaves, and that was certainly true of Atlantans, but.
Let's take a break here very quickly. Mark Wortman is my guest. His new book is called The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta. We'll resume our conversation after the break, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Mark Wortman. His new book is called The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta. If you want to be part of the conversation or ask a question, you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Mark, you've just told us about the sort of people who settled in Atlanta and arrived there to make their fortunes. And it would seem that the man who was the city's mayor during the Civil War years in many ways sort of represented that diversity of ideologies and of intentions when he lived there.
Yeah. Well, James Calhoun, the mayor of Atlanta through much of the Civil War, through virtually the entire Civil War, is in many ways a very typical Atlantan of the period. He left his farm in South Carolina as a 17-year-old orphan, penniless. He was the cousin of John C. Calhoun, the senator and former vice president, two-time vice president, who was the philosophical bedrock of Southern states' rights. So his young cousin, James Calhoun, penniless, rode into the western frontier of Georgia, where he became an Indian fighter. He managed to get an education as a lawyer. He soon grew rich. He became a politician, but as a wealthy Southerner, he bought land, he bought slaves, paradoxically, he was a person who was deeply committed to the Union. And prior to the war, he led the opposition in Atlanta to secession. And in fact, Atlanta voted heavily in the Abraham Lincoln election against the leading Southern candidate for secession. So when Calhoun, this leader of the opposition to secession, a man, in fact, whose son became a captain in the Confederate Army, he throughout the war did what he could to hold together this increasingly chaotic city. And at the same time, he did what he could to help this large population, or relatively large population, of Union sympathizers within Atlanta. Atlanta had a large provost marshal force, about a 700-man force organized by a man named George Washington Lee, that was composed primarily of unemployed teenagers and others who had managed to avoid the war. And it became kind of Lee's private army. And he imposed martial law on the city. James Calhoun opposed this imposition of martial law, had no idea how to deal with it, wrote to the government in Richmond, which told him, in fact, that martial law was completely invalid. But nonetheless, Colonel Lee's men imposed their brand of Confederate order on the city. And part of that included shadowing and, in some cases, throwing into jail suspected Union sympathizers. And in one case, at least one case, they beat one of the Union sympathizers to death. But Mayor Calhoun did what he could to get these when the Union loyalists were jailed. He managed to free them, and then throughout the war, you have this paradoxical situation in which the Confederacy's most important city in the Lower South was led by a man who was opposed to secession.
Yeah, he's such a fascinating figure in this regard. And over, you sort of sense this tension that he feels because his primary obligation is to protect the residents of his city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was he was a deeply committed civil servant. He was a person who really believed in the value of good government. His commitments, in fact, I think were the reason that he was never able to rise beyond local office. He was somebody who was part of a cohort of Georgia politicians who became major national figures prior to the war: Alexander Stevens, Howell Cobb, Robert Toombs, and James Calhoun, especially as somebody with that Calhoun name, should have been in a position to rise to national office. And he ran for office several times and was defeated because he refused to align himself with the more powerful Democratic Party and its leanings towards breaking free of the union if it came to it.
Yeah, and he was a very pragmatic politician in some ways, in that when he ran later on for Congress, he continued to oppose the 14th Amendment, but said, "I won't fight against it if this is what the voters want."
Yeah. He and again, he was defeated, and that was actually soon after the war. He was somebody, when you we say pragmatic, sometimes we think of pragmatic as a negative term, somebody who moves with popular views. He was somebody who wanted to get things done. He was somebody who wanted to see his town advance and his people have the opportunities for the best life they could. But this was a time of enormous ideological strife. There were you were going into a war when he was first running for Congress. You were coming out of a war when he last ran for Congress, and there was really no room in there for people who were not willing to take radical ideological stances to get elected. And the nation as a whole eventually paid a price in that horrible war. You know, we have to remember that when and this is to me certainly one of the lessons of the Civil War, is that when we allow our ideological differences to move to the extremes, that we create a situation in which civic order becomes harder and harder to sustain, and in which the possibility of violence emerges. And one of the things that that General Sherman, to quote a hated philosopher for many Southerners, he said that you might as well parley with a thunderstorm as try to control war once it breaks out. When violence comes, you don't know where it's going to go. And so somebody who held to the ideology of constitutional unionism, if you want to call that an ideology, to me it's just says civic order above all is what needs to be maintained. Everything else follows from that.
Mark Wortman is my guest. His new book is called The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Of course, the campaign to overtake Atlanta was a long and extremely difficult one. Can you talk for a minute about the sort of leadership that General Sherman provided on the Union side, and then talk about his counterpart, General Hood?
Well, he had two counterparts. He had General Joseph Johnston, first as the Confederate leader of the Army of Tennessee, and then John Bell Hood, two very, very different men. But first on General Sherman. General Sherman was somebody who had started out, he was a West Pointer, and he too had been an Indian fighter. He had come south in his first assignment after West Point. He had been a fighter against the Seminoles in Florida in one of the Indian removal wars there. Then he had quite remarkably, he had moved up after that assignment into South Carolina and then Georgia. He actually lived for a period in Marietta, Georgia, traveled all along through the former Cherokee lands in northwest Georgia. This was 20 years before he would return to go over that very same territory, fighting his way towards Atlanta. I mean, it's incredible that he actually knew the land he was fighting over better than the leadership of its southern defenders. General Sherman loved the South. His happiest days, he said, as a young man, were spent in the South. And in fact, when the war broke out, he was the superintendent of a military academy that was the precursor to Louisiana State University. But he was a person deeply committed to the Constitution and to the Union. He believed the Union was indissoluble, and he understood that separation meant war, and he sided with the North. But General Sherman was also deeply racist. He was every bit as racist as those people in the South who wanted to establish a white man's republic. And he would not allow he would not allow blacks at all into his army. When after the war, when the during the victory parade through Washington, when all of the troops marched through Washington, he would not allow any black soldiers to march with his troops. So this was a man who paradoxically loved the South, but he too valued Union above all. He was a person who understood that in order to invade the South, he was massing starting in January 1864, he began massing his army in preparation for that advance. He understood that he would be advancing into hostile territory, and he would need to have an enormous amount of supplies. He would need to have a very mobile army. And he was also a general who didn't believe or didn't want to have head-on confrontations with the enemy if it was at all to be avoided. And as a result, his troops had relatively fewer casualties than General Grant in Virginia, who was all hammer. He just wanted to bang against that wall until Richmond gave way. General Sherman was happy to dance around the Confederate defenders until he got them into a situation where he could basically squeeze the life out of them. And so he kept moving as he finally started the invasion in May of 1864. He moved down the railroad line, trying constantly to get around on the flanks of the smaller Confederate army headed by General Joseph Johnston. Joseph Johnston was a general, too, who preferred to avoid confrontation, and he also understood he had far fewer troops than the invading Union army. So he wanted to get into a position where that was defensible, but this was a strategy that might have worked when Napoleon invaded Russia and got caught in the winters at Moscow, but it wasn't really a strategy that could work in trying to keep the Union army away from Atlanta. They fought. There was a terrible battle at along the line that's demarcated primarily by Kennesaw Mountain, about 15 miles outside of Atlanta. Finally, that flanking strategy by Sherman finally forced General Johnston's Army of Tennessee to retreat back over the Chattahoochee River. And at that point, Jefferson Davis realized that Johnston was about to give up Atlanta. And he said, I need to have somebody who can be a very aggressive general now. And that's when he brought out, he replaced General Johnston with General Hood. General Hood was a far more aggressive general. General Hood was sort of the picture we have of the Confederate warrior. He had lost a leg. His arm was shattered. He had a big beard that ran down his chest, long flowing locks. And he was somebody who immediately wanted to go on the attack. But he was facing an army that was far larger than his own. He was trying to move men and supplies as quickly as he could at the same time that Atlanta was partially encircled. And he really he engaged the Union forces in three horrific battles that resulted in heavy slaughter of Confederate troops. And at that point, they withdrew within the ramparts, the earthworks surrounding Atlanta, and General Sherman at that point began his siege of Atlanta.
One of the things before the actual siege began that Sherman recognized was the importance of cutting off railroad access to Atlanta. Can you talk about Sherman's neckties?
Sherman's necktie. That was a name that was given to Union forces first under General Sherman. Spent a whole lot of time, much more time tearing up railroad lines than they did actually fighting. There are some. If you ever get it, your listeners ever get a chance, they should go on the Library of Congress website. They can find digital photographs of Sherman's men creating bonfires of railroad ties, setting railroad tracks they pulled up on top of the of these fires until they grew red hot, and they picked them up and they literally wrapped them, twisted them around trees, so that they look like a bow tie almost, and hence they got the nickname of Sherman ties or Sherman neckties.
And they had figured out that if they just bent them, they could be unbent and used again. But if they twisted them like that, they were pretty much scrap.
Yeah, exactly. It's always been a surprise to whether it was in World War II with the aerial bombardment or in the Civil War. When you tear up a railroad line, it takes less time to rebuild it than it does to tear it up, unless you destroy the tracks themselves and make them unreusable. General Sherman believed that the war was going to go on for years. He thought that it would be that the Confederates were not ready to give up, and he wanted to destroy every bit of railroad that he possibly could to make sure that they would never be able to continue the fight and, when Atlanta fell, fall back into the city and use it as a base.
Author Mark Wortman is here. We're talking about his new book, The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta. We'll return to the conversation in a moment. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Mark Wortman. His new book is called The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Mark, for those of us who weren't paying close attention in history class, I think we remember Sherman burning Atlanta. But in fact, the first really devastating fires were set by Hood's men as they were retreating.
Yes. In Atlanta is so shrouded with Civil War. Atlanta is so shrouded with myth and legend. We remember that amazing scene in Gone with the Wind, the movie, in which those siege victims, Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara, are fleeing through a burning Atlanta. The fire is raging around them. In fact, that's one place where the movie actually got it right, because if you were listening closely, you heard that the Confederates were the ones who had set off the fire. When on the night of September or the early morning on September 2nd, the Confederate Army was pulling out of Atlanta, and they had left a munitions train, 81-car train, on the tracks. They had not been able to get it out of town before General Sherman's army had moved around the city in another one of his flanking operations and cut off the last railroad line into the town. And at that point, the city had become indefensible. General Hood ordered that train to be set on fire, and that caused an explosion that lasted for several hours that was visible 20 miles away, audible even further away, and the that devastated everything for a quarter mile around the railroad track and set off other fires. There were millions of cartridges in the train, so there were bullets flying for days afterwards. The devastation described by people afterwards was comparable to what we think of as some of the worst bombings we can imagine. So that was really the first bonfire that destroyed a large chunk of Atlanta. Then when the Union Army finally did move into the city that day, coming into town, although General Sherman himself didn't arrive for a few days afterwards, he was with his troops to the south of the city, the Union Army made its home in Atlanta. General Sherman took up residence here. I actually am speaking to you from Atlanta, by the way.
Perfect.
General Sherman and his officers made their homes in houses around City Hall. And then General Sherman decided that his men, after 100 days straight of fighting, needed a rest. And so he decided that he was going to expel all the civilian population of Atlanta and turn it into basically a military bastion for the Union Army there deep within Confederate hostile territory. And for 2.5 months, his men basically had a green zone equivalent in the midst of the war zone.
Yeah, they were living large after having been sort of half-starved for months. Suddenly there was food around, and they found shops full of books to loot and all kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, there was a period of initial looting, but order was actually enforced pretty quickly by the Union provost forces. They did send out wagon trains to go out into the countryside and basically confiscate everything they could, no matter what a person's loyalty or participation in the Confederate cause was. Anything that could be taken in and consumed by the Union Army was taken.
And now here's when Mayor Calhoun's leadership comes back into play, because most people during that initial period of evacuation who could get out did, in fact, do so. On the other hand, there were pregnant women and elderly people and wounded soldiers who were not able to get out on their own feet. And Calhoun sort of begged for clemency.
Yeah. Yeah. Once the Union Army reached the edges of Atlanta, and those who could flee fled, including Mayor Calhoun's own family, but he chose to stay there. And he, throughout the siege, which was horrific, General Sherman claimed there were no civilians left in Atlanta when he started the bombardment of the city, and he was his artillery was raining down as many as 5,000 shells a day on the city. He was lying. He knew that the city was filled with civilians. His officers, artillery officers, could hear people screaming in the city, but. Mayor Calhoun stayed in the city, and then when the Union Army moved in and occupied it, he basically tried to cooperate. You could call this pragmatism. He tried to cooperate with the Union Army to try to allow the civilians who remained there, who in many cases were Union loyalists, to continue to live there. Many there were sick people, pregnant women, as you mentioned, the elderly, and then large numbers of former slaves. But General Sherman was absolutely intent on not having to face a hostile population there, to have to police a city, and he ordered the evacuation of all the civilians. About 1,800 went south. About an equal number went north. Mayor Calhoun was, of course, forced to leave as well. Mayor Calhoun wrote a letter begging General Sherman not to order this, and at that point, General Sherman made it clear to him. He said, "War is cruelty, and you cannot refine it." When the Confederates were ready to stop the effort to secede from the Union, the war and to give up the fight, the cruelty would end. And this is what we think of, what's come down to us as his total war strategy. And it was really an effort to convince the Confederates and their civilian supporters that they had no chance of winning. And that's been taken in to justify many other acts of cruelty. The terror bombings by air during World War II, for instance. And then it was also part of the debate during the Vietnam War era. Basically, there was it was always in the air, what would General Sherman do?
But he did not say war is hell.
He did not say war is hell. That's one of the myths, of Atlanta is that General Sherman at that point said to Mayor Calhoun, "War is hell." He probably never said that line. If he did say it, it was long after the war was over. It's right up there with, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, as sort of the hallmark of Atlanta as a an emblem of the Civil War.
Manufactured catchphrases. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Jerry in Keller. Hello, Jerry.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Tell us about the Episcopal bishop who was also a general, Leonidas Polk.
Sure. Okay. General Polk was the Episcopal bishop of Louisiana. He was a he was known as the fighting bishop. He was the head of the Army of Mississippi, who moved his forces in with to be under General Johnston's command in defending against the advance of the advancing Union Army into Georgia. Leonidas Polk was somebody who sort of was part of the great religious revival that swept through the Confederate forces in Georgia as they were defending their home territory and the lower South. He was a person of enormous bravery and maybe a bit foolhardy. He during the run up to the Battle of Kenesaw Mountain, the two forces were facing off in a period of relative calm, and General Johnston had his leading generals with him on top on a ridge on top of a mountain, overlooking where they could look down on the Union Army. And down in the valley in front of them, General Sherman came along and was surveying the positions of the Confederate Army in front of him. And he looked up with his scope at some men, not necessarily recognizable by him, who were standing out on a promontory overlooking them. And he said, what are these saucy people doing there? Let's make them jump. And so as he rode away, he ordered an artillery officer to fire on them. And General Johnston and the other generals on top of the mountain there, when the first shell landed, they ran for cover. And the fighting bishop, General Polk, stepped forward to the very edge of the mountain, put his hands on his hip, looked down at them in defiance. And it was the last thing he did in his life. a shell hit him directly, and he was killed.
I think, Mark, one of the really fascinating stories, and I guess it's emblematic of what Atlanta was and what it has become, is that General Sherman actually visited the city again a few years later and received at least a cordial greeting, including from Mayor Calhoun's own son, who was then mayor himself.
Yeah, it's one of the incredible facts of Atlanta's history that in 1879, General Sherman, who had up till that point refused to return to the South, and who at that point was the commander-in-chief of American forces, that he made a tour of the South. He made a railroad tour. He revisited many of the scenes of his greatest victories and came down with his daughters and some aides and came into Atlanta, where, amazingly, James Calhoun's son, William Lowndes Calhoun, was the then mayor. Atlanta was completely recovered from the war at that point. It was, while many cities in the South languished, Atlanta was already the thriving center of Southern commerce that we know it to be today, and and General Sherman rolled in on a passenger train coming down the very same railroad line that his forces had moved down into Atlanta 20 years prior, and he, or rather 15 years prior, and he received a welcome, albeit in a city that continued to have a Union Army presence, but Reconstruction had ended, which was something that General Sherman heartily approved, the ending of Reconstruction. And he came into Atlanta, where he received a very warm welcome. There was a, there were people, a large crowd turned out at the train station to see his arrival. He rode through the city. He stayed in a hotel downtown. There were festivities held for him. And Mayor Calhoun, who had been grievously wounded as a Confederate defender fighting against the Union Army during in the early stages of its invasion of North Georgia, was the leader of the city delegation in greeting him. And the two men spoke warmly. They spoke about...
I'm so sorry, Mark, that we're out of time now. It is a great story, and hopefully people who want to hear the end of it will pick up a copy of the book, which is called The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta by Mark Wortman. Mark, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.